Welcome to the WeatherPod, a podcast about the growing importance of weather information to business and society. I'm Alan Thorpe. I'm a former Director General of the European Centre for Medium Range Weather Forecasts, a former head of the UK Met Office's Hadley Centre, and a professor of meteorology.
And I'm David Rogers. I'm a former chief executive of the UK Met Office and am now a consultant with the World Bank, helping countries improve their weather-related disaster management systems and services.
Weather information is a critical international resource for saving lives, making business and society more efficient, and building resilience to extreme weather and climate change.
In each episode, we invite a leading expert to discuss how public, private, and academic sectors work together to produce weather information and make it available to business and society.
We also investigate how weather-affected public and private enterprises actually use it and the new business opportunities being created.
And because extreme weather often impacts the poorest the hardest, we'll look beyond the rich countries to the less developed ones, which host most of the world's population.
In this episode of the WeatherPod, we welcome Professor Hannah Cloke of the University of Reading into the studio. Hannah is a physical geographer, natural hazards researcher, and hydrologist specialising in earth system modelling, flood forecasting, catchment hydrology, and applications of numerical weather prediction. After her PhD, she worked at the European Commission Joint Research Centre in Ispra, Italy, on the European Flood Alert System, and then from 2004, she lectured at the Department of Geography at King's College London. In 2012, she moved to the University of Reading to a joint post between the Department of Geography and Environmental Science and the Department of Meteorology. Hannah was appointed as an ECMWF Fellow from the 1st of January 2021. Hannah, welcome to the WeatherPod.
Yes, a very warm welcome, Hannah.
Thanks, Alan, David. It's great to be here.
First of all, Hannah, I wonder, could you tell us what encouraged you to become a hydrologist?
I've always loved rivers since I was a little girl. So I spent my summer holidays down in South Devon, where my grandparents lived, digging on sandy beaches, intricate channels, channeling them up, swimming in Dartmoor rivers, and just watching the river flow. And I'm just fascinated by them. They are complex, they are tricky, they are all different scales. So from the little trickles you get on the beach to the River Amazon, stretching halfway across the planet. I just love them. But it's not just that they're really beautiful, it's that they are really complex and difficult to understand. So that is why I'm a hydrologist, because I love it.
That's a great answer. But let's try and pin down hydrology's relationship to meteorology. I mean, we know flooding is a hydrological phenomenon, of course, but it's frequently linked to an excess of rainfall locally, which of course is a meteorological phenomenon. So I imagine as a professor of meteorology, you could characterize the similarities, differences, connections between the two disciplines, of the two scientific disciplines of meteorology and hydrology.
Yes, there are lots and lots of similarities. So, I mean, you can see this if you look at a satellite image of swirling clouds, and then you look at perhaps like a photo of a river, some eddies forming in the river, and the different shapes and flows are very, very similar. So, there are lots and lots of connections between the two disciplines. Certainly, hydrologists tend to look at the more local level. So we look at a river catchment level, where people are, places. That comes much more into hydrology. There are problems because a lot of the water is hidden from us beneath our feet in the ground. So we have to guess half the time where it is, or at least use some equations to estimate where it is. And, there are some similarities with different parts of the atmosphere, but the complexity of the landscape and the influence of humans on that landscape really comes to play in hydrology. We don't quite see the same types of things in meteorology. We have lots and lots of interesting things, connections across scales, though. And I think it's a mistake to separate the disciplines of hydrology and meteorology, actually, because it is an earth system. And so my role, I think, as a professor of hydrology, but in a meteorology department as well, is to look at those things with both eyes and to bring the disciplines together.
Hannah, flood forecasting has made great progress in recent decades. What for you are the main scientific advances that have made this possible?
Yeah, it's really exciting, actually, how far we've come in the last 10, 20 years in flood forecasting. One of the things that I'm most excited about is this global approach. So this Earth system approach and the fact that we can now predict floods anywhere in the world. And I think a lot of that has to do with the disciplines of hydrology and meteorology coming together a bit closer so that we can use those tools together and we can use these global atmospheric models to generate forecasts of river flow and flooding. So that has definitely been really exciting. We've also seen different things like understanding the soil better, the snowpack better, and how we can put those into our models so we can understand the uncertainty and the things we can't quite see properly without digging up the entire planet.
So skill is really important. How is the skill or accuracy of flood forecasts actually assessed? Perhaps if you compare it with weather forecasting, how would you compare current flood forecasting capabilities with weather forecasting?
Yeah, I mean, so when we look at the skill of a river flow, we are looking at a point. So there's lots and lots of point-based measurements if we're thinking about flooding. And there are lots of skill measures that are the same, that we use the same types of tools in meteorology and hydrology. But we're most interested in that flood wave. So when the waters are going, you know, over bank, they're flooding people's houses. So it's that peak of the flow in the river that we're most interested in. And that's slightly different in the way you think about measuring things in meteorology. So meteorology is much more instantaneous. So I often have this when I'm trying to teach my students. They think about things in, you know, millimeters per hour, how much rain has fallen. But actually, when we're looking at the catchment, the hydrology in the catchment, we need to think over days. You know, where that rain fell 3 days ago, and it's trickling through the catchment, and the flood wave is then coming 3 days later. So these slower processes and the influence of humans as well, we have to take that into account. Now, this impact-based forecasting, I think, is the same in meteorology and hydrology as well. That's much more at the fore now. You know, does it matter? Who cares if there's a flood when nobody lives? You're only going to care about a windstorm or flood or a heat wave where people are and it's impacting them.
Just to follow up, Hannah, on that, one of the obviously the important things with weather forecasting is to get a really good estimate of the current state of the weather by taking lots and lots of local and global measurements. I wonder, is hydrology and flood forecasting similar in the sense of, you know, worrying a lot about the extent and the quality of the observational input?
Yes, I always feel like hydrology is a little bit of a poor cousin compared to meteorology in terms of the number of measurements, the deployment of satellites and other measuring techniques. And in many parts of the world, we are relying on people going out and looking at a stick, you know, in a river and writing that down. And there are lots of problems with quality, variable quality, and you don't even know what those problems are half the time. Certainly, gauge measurements have been going down in rivers. And it's not just rivers, of course, it's soil moisture and the other hydrological parameters that we're interested in, groundwater. And it's quite concerning how little we know about the rivers and the soil moisture and the groundwater stores across the planet. So yeah, quality is a big issue, and quantity.
If we could move on, perhaps, Hannah, to think about past flooding events. There have been a number of reviews of how we've done in terms of predicting those events, and they've consistently pointed to the importance of the linkage between the relevant scientific disciplines and also the links with the civil contingency decision makers when it comes to mitigating flood impacts. But these reviews have often concluded that a key problem is that these linkages are just not strong enough. Of course, in some countries, including the UK, there are national flood forecasting centres. I wonder, could you say how these centres have contributed to strengthening these linkages, and how do you see this developing in the future?
So I think that having these linkages, you know, it's absolutely transformative in terms of the ability to understand and communicate, in particular, the upcoming risk from flooding and different types of flooding as well. And if you look back before here in the UK before we had the Flood Forecasting Centre, when things were being done, you know, either on their own with the hydrology side and then on their own with the meteorology side, and there was, you know, not an adequate communication between the two. You know, there were some big problems in understanding not only, you know, the type of flooding risk that was upcoming, but also, you know, what people should do about it as well. And if you have that communication between decision makers, between hydrologists and meteorologists, you can get an overview of the entire event and you can see things through different eyes. So again, if we go back to rainfall, understanding rainfall as a meteorologist is this instantaneous, there's been this amount of rain, you have to understand what that does to the river system. And that can be quite different in different locations as well. So you have to understand the river catchment and that local context. And then you need to understand how to communicate that risk to the people on the ground or people who need to do something about it. And again, that requires a different type of decision-making context. So having all of those people in the same room, it's utterly, you know, the thing that people should be doing.
So do you think the consequence of that linkage has meant that there's, if you like, the public, the users of the forecasts are getting more advance warning of the flood occurring? Remember many occasions where on the news one sees someone from an agency actually standing in a river that's flooding and saying, well, now we know there's going to be a flood. But I imagine that the science now means that we can give quite a bit of a lead time to those forecasts.
Yeah, that's quite an exciting thing, actually, the ability to look, you know, a week ahead and see that something major is going to happen, and then to be able to get everything in place in order to take some decent action to stop that being a disaster. That has, we have come a long way in the last couple of decades on that point. But of course, there are lots of different types of flood events. So the really short, sharp kind of thunderstorm type flood events are still really tricky to get a handle on. So I think that there's more to do. So we're doing really quite well in some areas, but we've got to keep working at it to make sure that we can communicate that those really, really tricky short-term events better.
You're listening to WeatherPod with Alan Thorpe and David Rogers.
Hannah, could we move on a bit to think about what happens in low and middle income countries? As you know, the World Bank projects are really focused on developing countries, and river flooding is a huge problem. And could you say something about the Global Flood Awareness System, GLOFAS, which is part of the Copernicus Emergency Management Service, which has been developed by the European Commission and ECMWF as a global hydrological forecast and monitoring system. Perhaps you could tell our listeners a little bit more about how that works and how you expect this will help mitigating the huge impacts of flooding in low and middle income countries.
Yeah, sure. So at the University of Reading, we kind of do a lot of research with kind of the research wing, I suppose, of the GLOFAS system. So we've spent a lot of time putting the science into the system, but also working out how to use that in these types of situations. And if we look back 2 years, so March and April 2019, we were involved in cyclones Idai and Kenneth in Mozambique, and we were using the GLOFAS system to provide early warning and early information to our humanitarian partners that we were working with in Mozambique, and also to the UK government as well, who were then disseminating that through UN OCHA. And so we've actually been, you know, testing this in real situations to see what value we can get from these types of global flood systems. And the system works in this Earth system way. So we are coupling kind of the atmospheric forecast and then routing that through the landscape to calculate the floods and the probability of the flood. So it's not a deterministic system. And then, you know, transforming that into some information that people can use. So is it going to be a severe flood or a medium flood or a low flood at every location along the river? And then trying to help, work with the people on the ground to say, what does that mean? And we had some really good feedback on that. I mean, it's not a perfect system. It's just coming out, but it's really exciting because the feedback was, yes, this really helped our situation overview in Mozambique for these cyclones. Yes, you know, this fed into our decision making to know where we were going to deploy equipment, where you're going to put the boats that are rescuing people. So it's a great system. It's really exciting. It's technically absolutely, you know, you need huge computers to run this type of thing, but you also need to work with the people on the ground in order to understand whether it's going to work or not.
Are there obstacles you have to overcome to sort of get this really properly integrated into as a warning tool in many of these countries?
So one of the biggest things I think is, you know, the world is a very big place and there are many, many meteorological and hydrological agencies and humanitarian partners and other people needing or wanting this information or not wanting it because they're using something else, or it's a murky landscape. I like to think of it like a murky landscape. And that part of this is very, very important indeed, is to understand that wherever the cyclone's going to hit and cause flooding, it's going to be a different situation on the ground with different partners in play. They will have different capabilities or themselves. So it's difficult as a flood forecaster sitting in Reading working on a global system to understand all of that. A network of things. So that would be my first, you know, is the trickiest point that I think we have. But the other point is that we don't have enough data. So we don't have the observed data that we need. It's very, very difficult indeed to get river flow data, particularly quickly. You know, satellites can only provide some things. They can provide some estimation of flood extent, but we still don't have the technology that we need to understand what the river flow is all over the world.
It's interesting because we seem to be improving the sort of data exchange on the meteorological side between Met Services and centers like ECMWF, and we're probably doing less on the hydrological side, and they may be in the same agency, but the ability to share basic river gauging information isn't being done quite so readily. And so perhaps that's the message for us, as to how do we improve that? How do we share that to improve the global flood alerting systems?
I completely agree. We have to push forward in data sharing and open data for hydrology. It's the only way ultimately we're trying to help people not be in the way of floodwaters. So that's a major barrier at the moment that we have to keep working on.
Just to follow up on GLOFAS for a minute, Hannah, obviously as a global system, river catchments are of variable sizes. There are obviously large, medium and very small. And I imagine that GLOFAS has to concentrate just on the large ones. Is that right? And how large is large in this context?
Yeah, and that's a good question. I mean, the system was designed for the major world river basins. And that's because we don't have the resolution. The landscape's really, really complicated. And if you were to look at the local river here in Reading, the River Kennet, there's no way that you could see that even on the global system. It's not going to be there. The River Thames, which the Kennet flows into, is going to be there because it's a bit of a bigger river. But it depends, because sometimes you don't have to get the perfect signal out from the system to understand that there's some risk coming up. We don't have to get the river discharge exactly right. We have to just see a signal that something is coming and be able to communicate that there is this type of risk. And perhaps you want to look at the local systems because there's something coming in 7 days. So it depends how you want to use the system. And I think as a global system, at the moment, we can't give out river discharge for the whole globe and expect to be perfectly right. I mean, we might be there in 10 years. I hope so, because I'm going to keep working on it. But, you know, at the moment, that's not the purpose of it. The purpose is to highlight that something is going to happen and that, you know, you need to look at this and perhaps take some action.
Does it lead to a kind of strategy for observations at a local level? So you talk about, you can see the large rivers, and of course in many countries it's the same situation pretty much everywhere. You've got smaller tributaries, but they contribute substantially to the local floods. Would you say, well, you you should focus a lot on your tributaries, and if you get that, then we'll have an improved global system? Or what would be an advice from your perspective in terms of an observing network?
So the thing that I've learned about rivers is they're all very, very different. So you can go to the Amazon, and I have this on my desktop. I'm just in front of me. It's a picture of the Amazon in Peru and all of the tributaries coming off and all of the braided channels, and you know, wiggling everywhere. And if you then look at a different river in a different location, perhaps you go to the Limpopo in Mozambique, it's completely different. So the observing networks must be, you know, locally suited. They have to be. You can't deploy the same thing everywhere. I suppose it's a bit like working out how you're going to collect rainfall and temperature information on a mountain as opposed to a plain. You know, there is a geography here that's really, really important for rivers, and working out the observing systems is not straightforward at all. And we don't have it right. I think we definitely don't have it right. So I don't know the answer. And that is a big research question. And other people are looking at this at the moment. And I think if we have better satellite information to help blend those observing networks, and perhaps if we use some clever kind of machine learning techniques or something to work out where the optimal places to observe for different things as well, because we have to think about droughts as well as floods. It's no good just monitoring for floods. We need to work out when the rivers are very low as well. That's equally important. But if we blend all these things together, I think perhaps we'll come to this optimal observing network. But of course, somebody's got to fund that as well. And, you know, that's different in different countries. The borders between, in hydrology, the borders are crazy. I mean, we think of things in river catchments, but, you know, the infrastructure tends to work on political boundaries. So that's really, really challenging.
If we could move on to a slightly different topic, Hannah, thinking about climate change. I guess in the light of advancing climate change and population growth and rapid urbanisation, adaptation to likely future flooding is a critical issue. However, we know managing this is extremely difficult as people are living in more vulnerable ways, for example, in housing built on floodplains. And modern urban structures and agricultural practices seem to almost exacerbate rather than ameliorate flood risk. In view of all that, I wonder if you could point to any research initiatives that might suggest how these issues could be addressed in the near future. And would you be optimistic that they could be addressed?
So I think we're at a situation where it's very worrying. The future is very worrying because of climate change impacts, because of the way that we are dealing with the landscape. Increasingly huge areas of the planet are just making flooding worse. And as you say, putting people in the way of floods, and often those people don't have a choice. So displaced communities, poorer communities are often forced to live in the way of the floodwaters. So this is a bit of a ticking time bomb and something that we need to address urgently. Certainly there are things we can do. So I tried to be positive about it. So natural flood management is quite an interesting research area at the moment. And there's a natural flood management program here in the UK, a research program looking at the different ways in which we can use our landscape to kind of hold back and soak up the water, acting a bit more natural, whatever natural might be, but to hold it within the landscape itself. So for example, in Reading, we're looking at how you change the soil and make sure the soil is healthy. And really treat it as a precious resource. And in that way, it can hold on to that water that rains from the sky and stop it flowing straight down to the river. And those techniques are really important. And there are lots of different natural flood management techniques, working with natural processes. But they'll never kind of protect us from the biggest floods. So we're always going to have to do lots and lots of different things. So that's something that's really important to understand. And it's really, really encouraging that here in the UK, natural flood management is being taken really seriously. But we will also need to think about other solutions in different places, particularly where there are large cities already. There's no good just relying on natural flood management. We're going to need to move people out of the way, build differently. You know, there are radical solutions like building a floating housing or floating businesses, which will work. They work in other parts of the world, but it will require investment and planning and thought. And of course, in different parts of the world, there are different problems as well. So you can't solve everything with just looking at changing the landscape. You have to think about changing perhaps the politics and the way the way people react to different things, prioritize, perhaps even implement planning in some of those big cities that just have no planning whatsoever and use their rivers as rubbish dumps. So there's a lot to do, which of course is very exciting, but we should certainly see this as a worrying future unless we pull our socks up.
You're listening to WeatherPod with Alan Thorpe and David Rogers.
In a recent episode of the WeatherPod, we spoke to Rebecca Leonardi, and she's a principal in a company, WX Risk Global, a weather risk insurer. And Rebecca talked about the difficulties associated with insuring flood risk because there's no single cause, in her view. So, for example, flooding is not only due to meteorological or hydrological events, rainfall, river bursting their banks and so on, but also a failure of infrastructure and clearing of trees from water catchments, building in floodplains, and human operations like dam or water tank operations. What are your thoughts on the value of flood insurance and the difficulties associated with calculating flood risk?
Well, certainly, flooding is a tricky problem to understand, and all of those things and more contribute to flood risk, which is, why I quite like it, because it's really interesting and complex. And all of those things work together in lots and lots of different ways, so we can't understand it very easily. Flood insurance is very important, and those places that don't have adequate flood insurance on our planet, really, those people suffer greatly. So I'm quite a fan of the flood insurance system. I mean, there are ways to look at all of these different aspects. It is quite complicated. And in my mind, it's not that different to looking at, insuring your life. So life insurance, there are lots of different ways you can die, you have to kind of put them all together and work out the different risks from each. To do that for floods, you have to have this kind of both an earth system approach where you're looking at all the major large scale drivers of flooding, and then kind of a human locally centered approach. And I'm working on a project called Hydrosocial Extremes at Uppsala University. And that's where you look at the interactions of humans and the kind of the hydrology and really think of them together, and not only just kind of where people are living and what kind of decisions they do, but kind of the whole kind of socio-political framework around that. And I think if we could get some better models or some better understanding to bring together much better the kind of the physical science and these types of social science approaches, I think we get a much better understanding of flood risk, and we're not quite there yet. We've made some great progress, but I think there's more to do.
It's interesting. I mentioned dam and water tank operations, and I did that specifically because we see in many countries a flood situation with heavy rainfall, poor management of a water tank, overspilling, and then spilling, emergency spilling of the tank, and downstream flooding. And the reason is because they're not using the information that they have from hydrology and meteorology to manage the operations. Is there a possibility to start to bring in scientific information into management of human facilities like dams and water tanks?
So there's been some really interesting research in trying to feed decision making automatically by with the hydrology and the meteorology to make sure that the operations are really well tuned to what's going on there. But of course, that technology is quite expensive. So it only works in those places where the investment is possible. And the other thing is, if it's often that the infrastructure owners don't really want anyone to see their operations as well. So they're not really keen on sharing that information and the procedures that go into it with hydrologists and meteorologists. So the two-way discussion between infrastructure operators and the environmental climate scientists are not optimal. So I think we've got two different types of barriers here. One is kind of investment and Some of the major dam failures that we've seen have been perhaps because investment has been directed elsewhere. You know, once the dam's up, it's fine. We'll just move on and put the money somewhere else instead of maintaining the structure, which of course is essential. And I don't know, you know, that's a big problem to fix.
As we're moving our discussion towards a conclusion, Hannah, I wanted just to talk a little bit about one of our themes in the Weather Pod, which is the importance of the public and private sector organisations working together and how they do this in practice. So I wonder, how does this type of cooperation play out for flooding?
I think so. In the UK, certainly we are doing quite well. So I'm always really quite keen to work with industry. They're always very polite about the slowness of research and encouraging us to do everything in like a week when we normally take 3 years. But other than that, we get on really well indeed. So with the Natural Flood Management Programme, working with consultancy companies and insurance companies to try and understand how we can use or improve models, so environmental models of flooding, to understand the risk better, to work, you know, joining up kind of wind and flood and or coastal surge risk, to understand future flooding there. And I think actually there's no way that you can just go ahead and talk about doing things on your own with you know, just research institutions without understanding that there is a much wider world out there and people need to use this information. So I'm always really keen to work with industry.
I guess one of the areas where there's a good connection is that industry often can't really put in the efforts to or resources to do the sort of medium and long-term research. And they do and they should be looking towards academia to provide some of that. Do you feel they're open to that and they recognise that role for the academic community?
Yes, I think actually it works very well in this country. Just certainly I've seen, you know, a number of research programmes, you know, where there's been a voice from industry saying, you know, this is what actually our future looks like in this sector, but we don't know this stuff well enough. So again, natural flood management, this is something where, you know, there has been industry involvement from the beginning. So if you have that right at the start, you have this conversation, this open conversation between researchers and industry, you come out at the end with something not only that's high quality science, but much more useful for everyone at the end. So that's the ideal situation.
And I'm curious about data sharing between the public and private sectors. I mean, it's a big issue in meteorology. Is it the same in hydrology?
So there remain some barriers to do with proprietary data, particularly insurance. It's difficult to justify releasing that. But there are ways of getting around that. You know, we can have people seconded into different institutions. So PhD students, for example, can go and work directly, or researchers can go and work directly with companies. But we're coming to a place where actually we've seeing a lot of open data coming out. So the Environment Agency has released all of the river flow data. ECMWF are moving towards open data. You know, this is quite exciting because it means that everybody's got access to the same data sets themselves. I think we'll always struggle where people are making money with their products. They're not going to be able to share them openly necessarily. But there are ways around it.
Is the private sector actually making basic hydrological measurements, or is that mostly a public sector function?
So I think it depends what you mean by hydrological measurements. River flow is, you know, that's the Environment Agency looking at that in England. Soil moisture there. So there are some industries that would require that type of information, but mostly it's done in a central way and that is now open, so anyone can look at that type of information. But when it comes to things like which houses have been flooded and how badly they were flooded and how much that cost, that's a different type of hydrological information that, you know, as researchers we would really like to have more information on that, but it's much more tricky to share that.
Hannah, I want to just round off by thanking you very much for what has been a really interesting and illuminating discussion. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Hannah. That was great. So I really appreciated you joining us today.
Thanks a lot. It was fabulous to be here.
Well, that concludes this episode of the Weather Pod. We hope you've enjoyed it. David and I will be back next month. And in the meantime, please give us your feedback via email to support@gweforum.org.